Welcome back to the second part of today's seminar on Foundations of Positive Parenting. In the first portion of today's seminar, we talked about attending and praising and building up the positive foundations. Now, in the second part, we're going to talk more in depth about dealing with inappropriate behavior. One of the things I'd like to start out the second part with is basically bringing up this idea of the myth of what we call bad seed. That if I put time and energy in, my kid's going to just do what they want. It won't make a difference. The fact of the matter is, research shows that as time passes, when your child actually comes up against situations, when you're not there, say a peer is drinking or doing drugs or having a party, or they're having to make decisions about social situations, if you've actually set healthy rules and reasonable consequences, that they will remember that, and at least they will have that consideration of that. Rules also have to be seen as a symbolism that a parent or parental figure or guardian does love someone. Keep in mind things like, if you didn't have rules, that you wouldn't necessarily be showing love to your child. If you just let him or her, for example, run out in the middle of the street and didn't set a boundary about that, and they got hit, what kind of love would that be? If you didn't tell them to look both ways or stop, if you let them eat all the candy and sweets and chocolates that they could ever have, or bought every toy that they ever wanted, or let them hang out with just any old person that they wanted to, and had no discretion or no boundaries, would that really be love? Another thing that we're going to be looking at today is that a genuinely loving parental relationship focuses on the long-term blessing and instilling life lessons in the child, even though that child may feel like uncomfortable in the process. Rather than the child feeling upset and having some momentary pain, that parent chooses to focus on instilling long-term values. The other thing that we want to start with is making sure that there's an environment of relationship. There has to be a foundation of relationship in order for rules to really be seen as loving. Let's make sure that we're all on the same page about what the ingredients of well-done rules are. Well-done rules are delivered to a child one at a time. Rather than telling them, I want you to go to your room and clean that thing from top and bottom, pick up all those dirty clothes, put things in the laundry, clean things, and get all the trash away. Instead, you would give one rule at a time, break down that rule into the smallest parts, so it would allow the child to have the best likelihood of success. Well-done rules are specific. They're phrased positively. They tell a child what we desire him or her to do rather than what they shouldn't do. So instead of don't hit, punch, or kick when you're angry, keep your hands to yourself even when you're frustrated. It's okay to be frustrated when you don't like to clean your room or do things, but even when you're frustrated, you can share your feelings without getting physical. And perhaps one of the most important ingredients of well-done rules is the idea that the parents or the guardian actually support those rules with their own real-life modeling. It's one thing to ask our kids to not cuss, to not hit, kick, and punch, to listen up. But do we role model those things? All too many times I've seen in counseling sessions children that say, well, my parents do this, and they say, but we're the parents, we can do whatever. So there's some considerations we need to take in mind when we're forming rules. Are the rules we're coming up with actually reasonable? Are they for the well-being or the good of the child? Do they actually keep the child from danger and destruction? Remember, children, especially at certain developmental levels, don't really know what's good for them. They may think some of our rules are ridiculous, but sometimes what's actually good for them and keeps them from danger or destruction may not be realized on their part until much later. Do the rules that we're wanting to have teach the child a positive character trait or a value? Do they teach good stewardship of other people, places, and things? Do they emphasize self-responsibility? Do they teach good manners? And are they appropriate given this particular child's age, developmental level, and maturity of the child? I think it's real important that when we're working with parents in our counseling sessions, that we show them how to tailor their rules and consequences to each given individual child. All too often I see the parents and guardians make mistakes where they will expect maybe the second or third child to have the same rules and expectations as a previous child. And, well, this worked for so-and-so. Why is it not working for the next child? Remember, even if a child's mature in one area, they may be developmentally behind in another. What is the given age, developmental level, and maturity of that particular child? Effective rules tell the child what the behavior is that we desire and how to follow through on that behavior. So if we're wanting them to sit still during meal time, it leaves no room for ambiguity. We would say something like, during time when it's dinner, I need you to sit on your bottom and face forward with your face towards the plate, towards the dinner table where we're talking and where we're eating, without playing games, without doing other activities, but just eating and talking with the family during that time. Until later when everybody's had a chance to eat, and then you'd ask if it's okay to leave the table. Effective rules tell when the timing is. Does it make a difference, for example, if someone's visiting? Does the child still have to sit still at the dinner table? Or can we be a little lax about that? Is it every day of the week? Where is it to be performed? And what are the consequences or rewards? Let's look at some examples of rules that maybe aren't phrased the best and see what's wrong with them and what we could do a little bit better. So our first bad rule, or not properly phrased rule, would be don't go past the neighbor's house. What could be an alternative? Well, first of all, this rule is bad because it says what not to do. But it's not saying from a positive point of view what this child should do. Maybe something like, yes, you can play outside, but I don't want you to go farther than the end of our house, of our yard. I don't want to see you past the neighbor's house or down the street. I need you to stay in our yard if you go outside. And you might want to even be more specific about that as to what that means. You may even want the child to say back or show you or walk around the outside of the yard what that is, depending on their age. What about this next rule? Would you please sit in your seat like I told you? Well, just because we use the word please or we ask a child to do something doesn't mean it's a well-written rule or a well-said rule. We don't want to give the child an option or phrase things like a question as if they have an option to sit or to not sit in their seat. Instead, a better written rule would be, I need you to sit still in your seat while I'm driving and face forward. That means I need your bottom to sit in your car seat or on the back, on the chair of the car where we're going. I need you to be looking forward and not standing up or kneeling or goofing off, or I will be pulling the car aside and we will not be going to the fun place we are going to go to. What about this next one? If you keep it up, you'll be in big trouble. Well, this is pretty vague. It's definitely not specific. when the parent says, if you keep it up, we're not really sure what it is. It leaves room for the child to debate. Well, I wasn't doing that. Oh, you thought I was doing that? You see, there could be a lot of debate back and forth as to what it is. And big trouble. You know, the child could also debate that and say, oh, I thought you were just going to take away my dessert tonight. Oh, I didn't think you were going to make me go to bed early. Oh, I didn't think you were going to swap my bottom. Oh, I didn't think you were going to, whatever the consequences are. Instead, if I hear you screaming, yelling, and fighting with your brothers and sisters, and not playing in a way where you're taking turns and using indoor voices, then we're going to have to stop all the games until people can be quiet. And when we stop the games, we're not going to be able to play the new game that I got you. What about this next one? Do your chores. So this is positively phrased. It tells the child what to do. But wow, do your chores. Man, that could be a whole lot of different things. Could be picking up the trash, cleaning the room, vacuuming, make your bed, hang up stuff. I mean, do your chores. Is the parent and the child, are they both on the same page as to what the chores are? So it may be best to have a chore list, or again, give one chore at a time. Let that child show that they've done that. So we want to stay away from things like clean your room or do your chores. What about the rule of stop hitting? The thing is, that tells the person what not to do, but it doesn't say what they should be doing. So instead of using their body to hurt someone, what should they be doing when they're frustrated? I think a better alternative might be something like, when you're frustrated, keep your hands and feet to yourself and use your words to let me or let the other child know how you're feeling. When you're frustrated, go to another space to calm down so that you don't use your hand and feet in the wrong way. What about this next example? Be respectful. Now, that sounds pretty positive. I've heard a lot of parents say stuff like that. Be respectful. What's tricky about that is defining that word respectful. It's a big word. It's a word that's subject to interpretation. If you have a real smart kid, they might debate that they were or weren't being respectful. So it would be important to give a specific example of what respect is. It's important when you're doing these chores to show respect. I need to see you, even if inside you feel mad about having the chores, I need to see you try to not make bad faces, roll your eyes, or stomp around the room, but to try and do the chore and get it done as quickly as possible without a lot of complaining. So if respectful is without complaining, if respectful is calm and quietly, if respectful is within 15 minutes after I ask. What about play nicely? That sounds pretty positive. Again, nicely is open to interpretation. So maybe something like, I'd like to see you and your friend take turns and share the toys. It's important when we have a friend over that we make sure that we're alternating who has what toy and take turns, that we use our words to ask permission and alternate who gets to play with the toy. So we need to have a way of positively defining things. As I said before, instead of saying, don't hit your brother or sister, don't call names, don't yell, stop getting such bad grades, we need to define things positively. Keep your hands and feet to yourself even when you're angry. Use your words to tell what you would like to happen. Listen the first time you're asked to do something. So a lot of times what we'll do when we're working with a parent or a guardian is we'll want to come up with a rules worksheet of sorts. I actually sort of interview the child and the parent or guardian and separately see what they would say the rules are. It's actually rather humorous because a lot of times they'll tell me a little bit different variation. And I say, you know what? To that child, I say, I really want to be able to support you the times that you are doing the right things and make sure your mom, your dad, or whoever's taking care of you notice that and reward you. But I can't do that if I'm not sure what the rules are. So a lot of times they're cooperative at that point. We want to know what the rules are, what the consequences are for appropriate or inappropriate behavior, and what the rewards are. And so part of developing this rules and reward worksheet is also finding out what's personally meaningful to that child. Is it certain people that they like to spend time with, that maybe they could have a special day with a certain person? Is it certain hobbies that maybe they could earn time to do a little more of that hobby? Certain TV shows that maybe every now and then they could stay up a little later to watch? Favorite foods. Would it be possible maybe to plan a meal or they get to make the choices about how something is done at home or places to go, sports? Even knowing the things they like the least might be important. So one of the things that's important as we're dealing with children is we can actually give them signals to help increase the likelihood that they're going to do the positive pro-social behavior. This is where the positive parenting comes in. What we want to do is teach them to use incremental steps and chaining behaviors. So for example, we are going to be going to the grocery store to buy some things now. If you can keep your hands to yourself and stay by me in the store while I get groceries, you will each get to pick out one more special food for dinner. So that first step, they're signaled where they're going. They're cued about keeping hands to yourself and staying on task. Next step in the chain. We are walking in the store now. Let's remember to stick together and keep our hands to ourselves. Then the next chain. I wonder how many points we'll get. Let's start getting groceries and seeing if we can earn those special dinner choices. Next chain. We're walking well with our hands together. I like to see that. I really hope we're going to really get to pick a special food for our dinner or our dessert tonight. If we stay together the rest of the way now and keep our hands to ourselves, we'll really be a big team and we'll get to have those things. Let's see another example as to how these incremental steps and chaining might work. Your cousins will be coming over in 15 minutes. Let's go over the things that need to happen while they're here. Taking turns with our toys will get us 10 more points on our point systems towards some of the rewards we like. Next chain, the doorbell rings. They're here. Remember, sharing means 10 more points. Next chain, I know you all like a lot of the same toys, so we're going to take turns sharing. Then another chain, after the cousins leave. I know you hate to give up your toys sometimes, but you really let your cousin play with it too. What great sharing! What happens now? 10 more points. Or, if they didn't share well, here would be an option of a chaining at that point. Sharing can be hard when we want something a lot. Since we didn't share well today, we'll have to try again tomorrow at school for our 10 points. So you see how we're really trying to maximize the likelihood that our child is going to be successful. When we're setting up rules, we don't want our child to have more than 5 to 7 rules at a time. Let's say they have 5 to 7 things they're working on. There should be one rule that the child will always get. One thing they're almost across the board guaranteed to get points for, that they do really well, and that comes very easily to them. 3 to 5 of the rules should be things that they can do, they have the skill to do, but it's a hit or miss thing they could get a little better with. And then maybe 1 could be a new behavior that we're trying to teach as a pro-social skills. So there's some keys in terms of our responsibilities and general principles regarding when we give consequences to kids. We want to make sure that our response of consequences, whether it's a reward or whether it's a consequence for inappropriate or off-task behavior, is that we are prompt, that the consequences are related to the actual situation or rule that we gave. Remember I said it's really important to find out what's meaningful to that given child, to individualize rules to their age, their developmental level, and their maturity. So this means, in other words, that this has to be a consequence for that particular child. It has to involve some educational component of teaching correct, respectful, or pro-social behavior. One of the things we have to also be very careful about is when we're correcting a behavior that's off task, is that we don't give more attention for non-compliance than compliance. Try to start with politeness. Please use statements rather than questions. And also physically, make sure you're in close physical proximity to the child when you're giving these rules. Some of the problems that we have is that parents oftentimes don't spend enough time affirming what goes right. And that's one of the key foundations with this positive parenting. We make a big stink when the child's off task, when they're not doing the right things. But we've not done that good foundation laying before we do foundation building. We need to affirm when they do the right thing. We need to give consequences after we know that they understand the rule and the reward. One of the other shortcomings parents do is sometimes they don't do that cueing or prompting. Again, I know it may mean extra effort on your part as a parent or a guardian, but if the goal is to get them to do what the right behavior is, if that's what helps, then let's go all the way and encourage them with that. One of the other problems we have is we ask our child to do behaviors that maybe they've not demonstrated that they know or understand or can do consistently enough yet. We want to make sure that this child can do this behavior. That's why a lot of times in counseling, I will actually do some role plays to make sure the child understands. Because it's not uncommon that a child would nod their head yes, that they've understood you, just so you'll stop talking about it. But they inside may not really understand what's going on. Another issue parents have is sometimes the atmosphere in their home or in the community when they're working with their kid is so chaotic. There's so much instability that it's hard to focus on one task at a time. There's not really a routine or consistency. So let's look at some areas that we could really increase this positive parenting. We talked about attending earlier on, but I want to review this because we cannot minimize the importance of attention. Attention, whether positive or negative, motivates a child. So why not let it be positive attention? We can name and show that we are noticing the behaviors a child's doing. We can be a news reporter of sort, notice any changes, however small, in behavior. Positive attention is akin to prevention. It's so much easier to prevent harmful, negative, or non-prosocial behaviors than to have to go back later and correct things. Positive attending notices, describes, imitates, and comments on what's going well. It's very similar to, if you know anything about the solution-focused approaches in counseling, It's as a parent or adult consciously tuning into the appropriate or the neutral behaviors. It's learning to ignore off-task behavior that's not destructive. It's focusing on quality of the relationship with your child, having that special time where you're just noticing what they're doing. Problems that parents have when they're just trying to attend to things is they interrupt, they give advice, they correct, they debate opinions with their kids. And those are the type of things that actually frustrate the child. So let's look at a few examples here and see how the parent could just attend, even when there's some frustrations in the mix. Megan gets up early to try and make a breakfast for the family. She sets a table and tries to cook up something she's seen Mom cook before. This is her very first time surprising the family with breakfast. The mix for the pancakes has gotten all over the counter, and there's a few extra eggs that got dropped accidentally on the floor. This was a surprise for the family, but not exactly the kind they were hoping for. Ooh, it would be awfully hard as a parent, wouldn't it, to just attend to that? Part of attending is assuming, unless you absolutely know different, that your child's motivation's positive. When Megan was trying to get up and make breakfast for the family, it sounds like her heart was in the right place. I might say something like, "Wow, I noticed that you had a plan here. There was something you wanted to do while we were still asleep." And you could hear the child's good intention. And even oftentimes when you do the attending, the child will bring up the areas they're frustrated in. They might say, "Yeah, I tried, but it messed up. The stuff went everywhere." But then you can affirm, "Well, it seems like you wanted to try and help with the breakfast, but it didn't go quite as planned. What can we do to make this better next time? Or what can we do now? How can I help you with finishing the breakfast that you wanted to make for everyone?" Because if we get into a big debate about, "You messed up the floor, you did this, you know, we make assumptions about how bad the kid is, we start correcting, we can miss the opportunity to teach a lesson to help the child problem solve with us. What about this next example? Max has brought home his grade card for the semester. His grades that were F's have become D's. He actually got an A- in physical education. "See, I will just never be great in school," he comments. So, inside you might be thinking, "Well, gosh, he only got D's. I mean, he's not failing, but he's not doing much better." But if you say that, if he's already feeling down on himself, is that really going to help? If you say something like, "Wow, the only thing you did good in is phys ed," that's not going to get you far in life. It's the reading and math and science that will help you. Why can't you do better in those? Probably not going to work real well. But if you really want to problem solve in the long run about how to do better in school, the key is starting by positive parenting. Focus on what has gone well. So I've noticed that some of the grades that were F's before have been brought up to D's. Tell me a little bit about how you managed to do that. And he might say, "Well, they're only D's. They're not much better." I understand you feel like you've not made as big of a difference as you'd like, but something must be going in the right direction. Then, as the discussion continues, you could say, "Let's imagine what doing better in school would be like. You feel like you're not just going to be great in school, but you've been better. Maybe you're not where you think you could be, but something's in the right direction." And so we could kind of break down what's in the right direction and help him problem solve. Now, part of increasing pro-social behavior is actually in our counseling sessions and then also outside of the sessions, reinforcing with parents and guardians, building social skills. We should never go into counseling sessions assuming that a child knows something, that they know how to do a certain social skill. I know one of the mistakes I had made and some parents had made years ago when I started working with parents and families is that just because a child might be gifted or advanced in certain areas, assuming that that child was also advanced in other areas. I remember there was one child I counseled that was 4 years old, and boy was this girl mature for her age. Developmentally, in so many areas, she seemed advanced. The words she uses, the way she expressed things, just her mannerisms. But then there were a few areas where, in terms of social relationships, she was not behaving as well as she could. So one of the key things I had to work with the parent on was being careful about this idea of my gifted, intelligent child and making sure that she still understands that age-wise, she's still 4 years old. There's some areas and some life experiences she just hasn't had still, and some things that do need to be actually taught. So we had to go through what areas of social skills this little girl needed to learn. Social skills are not automatic. Think of social skills basically as a type of language. They affect how to make and build a relationship, how to keep a relationship, even the quality or the degree of happiness and contentment in a relationship. We're looking at interactions like at home, at school, and in the community, how someone does problem solving, how they manage conflicts. How someone actually does social skills can affect other people's perception of them. The literature shows that people who demonstrate strong pro-social skills are actually seen as more happy and more likable and more approachable by others. So let's look at some examples of pro-social skills that we can work with kids on. One of the first ones I start with is, how do you meet someone? How do you introduce yourself? I think it's kind of funny, but makes sense, that a lot of times people don't always understand what they have to do to make a connection with someone. We'll role play things like this in the counseling session. How do you stand up? How much closeness or distance do you have from someone? Look the other person in the eye. I've had some people that say, but these other kids know I need a friend. They always see me alone. And I might have to teach someone about how eye contact is important. That if your head's down or you look sad or you look shy or look away or feel like you don't want anyone near you or aren't open to relationship, that someone might not know that you want to make a friend. Smile. Start with an introduction like, hi, I am, fill in the blank. Or make a comment about a joint activity that both of you are doing or what's happening that day. One of the exercises I'll do with some people to help them understand this further is basically developing what I call a help wanted ad that says friend wanted and fill in the ad. What's the age or type of relationship they're looking for? What qualities, what expectations do they have? And how do they communicate this to the other person? One of the biggest things that I work with people on, whether they're kids or adults, is that oftentimes they have assumptions that people around them just know that they want to be their friend. But the fact that I tell them is that if you haven't told them, if you haven't given them signals in words or in your behavior, we can't be sure that they know. So let's give some examples that I might role play in a counseling session. You see three other kids playing ball. You would like to join them, but you're not sure if they want someone new in the group. Now, I've had some kids who really didn't know pro-social skills that would just come up and grab the ball. I've had others that would take it and bounce it away from them or kick it away from the group. I've had others that would try and make fun of somebody in the group. There has to be words or something to let the kids playing ball know that you'd like to be part of the group. Maybe something like, wow, I see you guys playing ball. That's a game I like to play too. I'm wondering if there's any time I can play with you or if I could be part of the group. And then waiting for a response, how to deal with the different types of responses that the other kids might have. That you might have to wait your turn. You might have to alternate playing with the ball if there's only one ball. You or another person might have to sit out while the other two are playing and then alternate who's playing with the ball. What about a second example here? There's a new student in class this year. You wonder if they could become your friend. You recall what it was like being new last year yourself. You wonder if the child feels alone and how they're doing with being in a new school. So this comes to the point of perspective taking. Sometimes you might want to be friends with someone, or you might think they're looking for a friend, but you're not sure how to approach them. You might even just want to say, you know, I see you over here and you look like you might be a new person. I'm not sure if I've seen you before. Are you new at school here? Just point blank asking. And then, hi, my name is so-and-so. Would you like to have a new friend? Or tell me about where you came from if you're new here. I remember what it was like being new here. What about this last example? You would like to play with another child, but this one is taller and more popular than you. How do you approach him? Well, sometimes we look at these qualities and we think, wow, all the kids like this person. They're taller. They're more popular. People aren't going to want to play with me. I'm shorter. I'm not as good at this person. I'm not so famous and I don't have so many people liking me. But what people forget is there's a lot of different qualities about people. Not just they're popular, not just they're taller, not just they're good at that. But this person may want someone to play with as well. So we role model how to approach someone. One of the things that I also talk with kids about, and this is a skill in terms of relationship building, is how to find commonalities. Sometimes kids wonder what they should talk with a prospective new friend about. They're like, okay, I said my name, I smiled at him, now what do? I tell them, just look, just observe. See what you like, what do you believe? Is there anything they're doing that you might like too? Maybe they're playing a game, a sport, or a hobby that you like. Maybe there's certain foods they like to eat. You're wondering what they are. They're different from what you eat, or that's the same thing that's your favorite food. There's certain music they listen to. Maybe there's certain school subjects that you notice that they're into. You could talk about what you want to be when you get older, your siblings or your family, where you live. But finding something in common or asking about the things that they're into is a great way of trying to make a connection. These are things that may need to be taught as well. Expression of feelings. Remember I said that people who state things directly and have pro-social skills are seen as more likable. Well, likewise, both children and adults who express their feelings are seen as more likable, more intelligent, more personable and friendly. They have better social development. And so what we're talking about is how to name what you feel, how to name the way you're experiencing things, how you see the situation going, and expressing it in a balanced way where you share what you're going through, but you also allow freedom to the other person to share his or her perspective. You use dignity and restraint. I actually will sit down and, if you look at your PowerPoint, maybe make a chart with a child. You see the different columns I have on this worksheet of understanding all my feelings. We'll take a feeling like excited. What behaviors do I have when I'm excited? I might jump up and down. I might wave my hands. I might cheer. And what kind of thoughts do I have? Wow, this day's going great. I wish I'd have more days like this. Or I can't wait to tell someone about what's going well right now. What about feeling sad? I wish the thing I was trying to make in art class turned out better. I tried to do this very hard, but I'm not as good at it as I thought. Then what about thoughts? It's really hard when I try to put a lot of effort into something and it doesn't turn out the way that I hoped it would be. So active listening involves labeling feelings with a word and making a general feeling statement. You may have heard of the I messages, which again is a foundational skill that I use with children as well as adults and caregivers. I think if people can use this as a formula in their interactions with each other, it makes things easier because everyone's on the same wavelength. And like I said, I do teach this separately to the child as well as the parent or guardian. So it's not just the child learning it, but the parent also role modeling it. The I message contains three parts. I feel such and such, when or because such and such happening, and in the future, I'd like such and such to happen. The reason I call it an I message is because it's just talking from your own point of view of what you're experiencing. What happens is usually when we're frustrated, we tend to do the opposite. We tend to do what we call a you message, which is blaming, threatening. And I'll explain when I teach I messages to the child and to the parent how easy it is to do these you messages. We also talk about how to catch the you messages. I'll even encourage them to take time when they're in a disagreement, say between the child and the parent, to write down their initial thoughts and feelings. And I'll say, you know, the first thing that comes to our mind usually isn't an I message. It's usually not like this formula. It's usually more like, you hurt my feelings. You're never nice to me. I wish you would stop being such a bully. Instead of, I feel hurt because there's yelling and name calling. And in the future, I'd like us to try and talk more calmly, even when we have differences of opinion. So the I message is, the part I usually start with people on is what went well. Not just what's going bad or what could be changed, but what do you hope to continue? Let's take a look at some of these examples and see how we could maybe phrase them in terms of an I message. I practiced hard for many days for my science presentation and actually got a B when usually I do poorly in that class. For an I message, I might say, I feel excited, encouraged, because I put time into practice and my grade showed it. I feel surprised because I didn't know that putting this time in would make that big of a difference. In the future, I'm thinking my mom and dad might have been right about spending a little more time studying. Let's look at the second example. I was chosen for student council by my classmates. might say, I was surprised because I thought the other person running against me might win. And in the future, I'm wondering if maybe I should give some things a chance and not always think of the worst, that I won't get picked. Or I feel happy that I was chosen for student council because I think that I have some good ideas and can make a difference. Let's look at the next example. I worked hard at a babysitting job and was able to save up money for shoes I wanted. I'm proud of myself because I babysat and it paid off. Now I'm on my way to getting the shoes I like. What about this last one? When I got my first job, I was named Employee of the Month after only being there 2 months. I feel excited and motivated on my job because they noticed my efforts even though I was only there 2 months and they gave me the Employee of the Month award. Now let's progress to where we can use the I messages for dealing with some stressful or tough unpleasant situations. These are times that it's a little harder to do this, so let's see how we'll figure it out. My best friend went and told the others in class my secret. I feel disappointed, sad. I feel angry because I thought when people are friends, if they ask someone to keep something a secret, they should do that. In the future, I'm not sure I want to share really important stuff right away if someone might break my secret. And you notice I slow down when I try to formulate these I messages. That's one of the positives of using the I messages and teaching that to the kids and to their guardians, is that it causes your thinking process to slow down. Look at the next example. When I returned from the restroom, I found my art project and a bunch of pieces on the floor. I'm sad. My heart just feels crushed because I saw my art project I worked so hard on all over the floor. In the future, I think I should put it to the side to make sure no one bumps into it next time. What about the next example? After I studied so hard for that test, I still got a D. I feel disappointed because I did take time to study, and yet the grade still was a D. In the future, I'm not really sure what I should do, because my studying didn't seem to make a difference. Now, if you notice in this example, if the person's not sure what they should do, they could look for a mentor or someone to help them. They could consider what their options are and even ask, I'm not sure what I should do from here. I felt like I did the right thing, but it didn't work. What about this next example? My dad died when I was 10 years old, and my grandmom had to raise me. I still feel sad when I think about my dad dying. I miss him a lot, but my grandma really has been great. I want to appreciate my grandma for all she's done, even though I still feel sad when I see other kids have their dad at different school events. Let's look at the last example here regarding iMessages. I live in a rough neighborhood. There's police sirens all day and night, gangs, and even walking to the bus stop and home from school can be fearful. I feel afraid because my neighborhood has a lot of crimes. I don't even know what to expect from one time to another. People don't always realize what it's like living where I live. In the future, I really wish that someone could maybe walk home with me Or, really, that someday my family could move to a neighborhood that doesn't seem as scary to me. So one of the things we're helping kids, excuse me, and their parents or guardians do is self-evaluate, look at their own and others' nonverbals, focus on what they're supposed to be doing, and how to communicate that using the iMessage. I've included also in your PowerPoints what I call a listening assessment. There's actually some questions and some skills that we can teach people about listening. So first of all, do you ignore people when they say something you do not want to hear? One of the things we need to teach those that we're teaching pro-social skills to is the idea of listening and perspective taking. Not just when we agree with or like what the other person's saying, but just to try and see if we can hear maybe those three different parts of the iMessage. What is that other person feeling? What do they think the situation is? Might differ from us, but we're still just going to see if we can understand from their perspective. And what is it that the other person really wanted to happen? Next question. Do you concentrate more on the speaker's appearance, mannerisms, or accent rather than the content of what they're saying? That's something we want to avoid. A lot of times I know with kids growing up, it's sometimes easier to look at, oh, look at that teacher. He or she wore a weird outfit. Their hair's different. Their mannerisms. They're talking funny. But the key is helping people focus on the content. One of the other things we want to help them notice is how to not assume what's going to be said next, but to listen through the whole comment or the behavior of the other person. Not to shut off when you disagree listening with somebody else of what they're saying. Do you just listen for facts or get the big picture, the idea? So it's real important to listen to all the different details about it. One of the other things we'll look at, do you look around and pay attention to things around you when someone's talking? That can be a challenge for a lot of people because they might be looking every which way. But it's real important to teach how to be single focused on what's happening at that time. In fact, sometimes when I'm working with parents and children, or working with a family, or just a group of people, I will use an object to show who's the person talking. So when we pass the object back and forth, it gives us a clear signal of who we're supposed to be looking at or focusing on. What about with notes? Do you just listen and not take notes, or find later that you really didn't even write anything down? Do you focus on outside noises that distract you? Do you take each situation as something new to learn rather than trying to connect it to what you know? Now, this is another skill that we may need to teach someone about. Is there something you already know that you can link this thing to? So, for example, I remember working in tutoring with a kid years ago, and he was really into sports, but the traditional academics he didn't like. He had to do a project for a history class, and instead of looking at the North and the South and this battle and that battle and this person, we put it in terms of two different sports teams. If this sports team was against this sports team, what are the strengths they had? What are the downfalls they had? What were the things that they needed to learn along the way? And that made it a whole lot easier for him because he might not remember a lot of things about history, but he did know sports. And when we put it in terms of sports, he really started learning history better. So one of the things we're looking at is encouraging people not to close off their mind to other perspectives, to other important aspects of things. We're basically giving these different guidelines about how to listen, when to ask for help. So some of the guidelines we're teaching is how to practice listening and attending skills, even when you're tempted to guess ahead as to what might be said. Focus on the message, not the details of the person's looks, voice, and accent. Learn how to hear differing points of view and take perspectives. Use techniques to aid memories, like note-taking, visualizing things. And ask yourself as a reminder, what am I supposed to be doing? Be prepared, review ahead, if you know what topic might be something people are going to talk about. Choose seating or positioning that shows that you're listening. Have a way to record your thoughts so that you don't interrupt the person when they're talking. Don't assume you know everything ahead. Wait and hear all the way through what the other person's saying. Practice listening because it doesn't come naturally. So we're going to talk about antecedents, behaviors, and consequence. These are really important parts of increasing positive parenting. Antecedents have to do with what happens before the current action. People's temperament can make a difference, how they respond to things. We look at some children tend to just be leaders, more assertive, more of a world changer. This happens a lot with firstborns, more confident, determined, and strong-willed. Oftentimes, one of the antecedents or one of the reasons why children misbehave is to get undue attention or to be noticed. Sometimes they misbehave because they want to be in charge. They may feel like they don't have control over many things in their environment, but they could potentially have control over something if they were acting out and the attention was on them. Sometimes children also misbehave to demonstrate they're hurt over something and they need some validation for their feelings. Sometimes they just feel they might be inadequate at something. So we need to really observe what skills might need to be taught. When are the behaviors changing? Is there a certain time of day? Is it harder for a child to do a certain thing in the morning, the afternoon, the evening? What patterns do we notice? Has a child really had enough practice in a certain area? So when we're talking about antecedents, we're talking about something happened right before the behavior of concern. And we're learning to ask ourselves, and we're teaching these parents and guardians to do this, what shifted or changed? We're helping them learn to tell the whole story. So let's look at some examples here. My child screamed and ran out of the room away from his sister. What might have happened before? Maybe sister and him were not taking turns on something. And he was frustrated and wanted it all to himself. What about this next one? My child laid her head down at the table and refused to eat any dinner. There could be a lot of antecedents. Maybe they thought dinner was one thing and they saw it was something else they didn't like quite as much. Maybe they started feeling sick prior to that, and they were wanting to obey and listen, but they just felt tired or run down. What about this next example? I received a call from the police that my teen was found on the streets past curfew. What happened before? They got a call from their best friend who told them about a wonderful event that they felt they couldn't miss out on. They felt alone because they felt like all their other friends or their group in school was involved in a certain thing and they didn't want to miss out. They knew that I wouldn't probably let them go. What happened before? My child starts saying, no, no, no. I asked my child to do something that they didn't want to do. And notice what I just said, I asked my child. That goes against what we talked earlier. Healthy rules are not phrased as questions. They're phrased as statements. What about my child said to me, I hate you? What could have happened before? Maybe we ask them to draw their attention away from something they would rather be doing. Maybe they were playing a video game. Maybe they just saw us as the great frustrator who got them away from the plans they wanted to do. Maybe they felt like we're not understanding where they're coming from. And that might be a cue to have to do more attending or more perspective taking. Maybe they're trying to get the focus off themselves and onto you to see how defensive you might be. Let's look at this next example. My child cleaned his or her room. Wow, that's a positive one. Why would we even want to look at what happened before? Because if something's going right, we want to increase the frequency of that happening. My child cleaned his or her room. Okay, what happened before? I did some cueing. I said that if these certain tasks were done, and I gave them a list of them, that in the afternoon, we would go to their favorite place. My child's been wanting to have a friend over for a long time, and they were reminded that if I come back and check and these certain things on the list are done, they can have their friend over for a sleepover tonight. What about this last one? My child got water all over the bathroom when he was trying to give himself a bath. Now remember, as a parent, you can sort of make or break the situation by how you deal with it. If I go in yelling like, "Ah, you messed everything up again," then it's going to be really hard to deal with. But what happened before? This child wanted to try and do something on his own. He wanted to show me that he was a big boy and could take a bath just as much as when I was trying to give him a bath before. So I don't want to make him feel bad that, oh, you did a rotten job. It's important to look at these antecedents because it can make a real difference if we consider them. Another thing we need to consider just as much as what happened before is what happened after. How did we respond to the situation? Because we can really make or break a child's enthusiasm by that. What if our reaction is, I yelled at my child? That child might think that, well, whoever's the loudest wins. Maybe they try to get louder than you, and it becomes a yelling match or a power struggle. That didn't work too well. What about this next reaction? If I told my child how inappropriate he or she is acting? That could work, or it could not. It depends how it's done. What if I said, well, there you go again. You never do things right, do you? You're always wanting to pick a fight with me and do it your own way. That probably would not go too good with that child. But if I did something like the chaining or the cueing we talked about earlier and said, remember, we talked about when such and such happens, then this positive consequence, I didn't see that behavior happen, so I'm not going to be able to do that. But let's see how we can get a good reward and try again. Let's look at another consequence. I told my children, your siblings have never acted like that. That's a big no-no. Comparison. We talked in the first section about hindrances to empathy. And comparison's one of them. What about I reminded my child calmly but firmly of the rule? That could really work. The timing is important. Usually I'd wait until the child has de-escalated to do that. Another one that can work in terms of consequences is I remove my child from the problem area. I decided to take a parenting class. Let me give you some suggestions here about alternative responses of parents. Things that really could work in terms of better consequences that we could do to change the scenario. One could be we could label feelings and normalize. Oh, you felt sad because you thought things were going to go this certain way and they went another way. You know, I feel sad when I hope things go one way and they turn out another way. It's really a disappointment. And then you kind of wonder, gosh, why didn't it go the way I hoped? Another response is you can cue your child into positive, alternative ways to get attention. If you think that one of their goals is getting attention, you can help them find other ways to do that. Children also like to feel they're in charge. Sometimes they like to try and control situations. You can give your child something to be in charge of. I found that sometimes some of the kids with the strongest will that parents thought were the most defiant actually wanted just something to be in charge over. And sometimes giving them the smallest things like folding the sheets to put away or mopping the floor. I'm not saying they did it well or they were expert at it, but to try it just to have their own chore made a big difference. Another alternative response that a parent or a guardian could consider would be to set up situations for the child to be able to problem solve. This gives a child the idea that you know something, you're creative, you have good ideas. Let's use our imagination as the way I would introduce it. Let's use our imagination. If we tried to redo that story, the way it worked out this time, it just didn't turn out so well. So let's see if there's another way we can do that. We also could offer choices, but we want to make sure when we give our child choices, they're within some limitations. So let's say your child isn't so keen on vegetables. You have peas or carrots. We're going to have a vegetable with this meal tonight. Which one do you want to try, the peas or the carrots? I'll need you to take 2 spoons of one of them. You can either try 2 spoons of peas, 2 spoons of carrots, or 1 spoon of each of them. But we'll need to get 2 spoons of vegetables in. One of the things that we can also do is just a timeout. You've heard about timeout, which the idea behind it is just stop what isn't working. And that could be for the parent to take a timeout. It could be for you as a parent or guardian to walk away from the situation. Find a neutral place so that you don't scream and yell. So that you don't lose your cool. If you're not able to do the attending and naming in a positive way. If you're not able to redirect. If you just know it's not going to be healthy. Withdrawing from the situation. But also letting your child know at the same time that you're around. I don't mean going way somewhere far away where they don't know where you're at. Or having your child do that. But just a stop and a pause. There needs to be a way to do thought stopping and a pause. Don't take the child's behavior personally. This is one of the pitfalls I see a lot of parents do. They will so personalize their child behavior and look that, you know, why are they doing this to me? Why are they upsetting my day? When the fact of the matter is, children usually aren't trying just to tear your day down. Listen to empathize. One of the most helpful things about all the things we talked about today, I can't highlight enough, is that foundation of the I messages and then using the I messages in reverse to try and understand where the other person's coming from. We can role model that for our child. Oh, it seems like this is what you're feeling. Is that what you're feeling? Oh, this is why you're feeling that way. Tell me a little bit more about that. This is what you hoped would happen. We want to stay away from criticizing personhood and just talk in terms of desired behavior. We want to train and role model social skills. And we want to be good examples of those things that we're teaching our child. We want to focus on what's going well. One of the mistakes a lot of times parents do is they problem solve for their child rather than helping their child by cueing him or her into problem solving. So there's steps that we can teach and we can role model for a child about problem solving. First of all, what am I supposed to be doing? What are my choices? Let me remind myself what I was supposed to be doing. Number four, let me use my imagination to pick a choice. What if I did this choice or I did that choice? What could happen? How could other people be affected? Would that really give me what I want? Okay, now that I've tried that choice, the last step, I need to check my choice. If it was a good choice, I'm going to say good job and think about what went well and how I could make it go well more. But if it's a bad choice, what can be different? So we'll start by going slowly, saying these steps out loud and practicing them. An example would be this first one here. You have a lot of homework tonight, but this is a night of your favorite TV shows. If you really put the time in you need to, you won't be able to watch the TV shows. What would you do? Okay, what are we supposed to be doing? Oh, I'm supposed to be doing this boring homework. Okay, what are your choices? Watch a TV show? Okay, let's put that choice down as one option. If you watch your TV show, let's use our imagination. What could happen with that? Oh, you would know what's going on with the TV show, and that would be super fun to see the characters right away. But that would kind of, Mom and Dad would be pretty grumpy because you still have to do your homework. It wouldn't be done. Might not know the next day what's going on in class, so you might be behind. And if that teacher happened to have a pop quiz, probably wouldn't do so hot in that, huh? Okay, so let's see if there's any other choices. I could do my homework and maybe Mom or Dad could record that show. I really don't want to miss it. I don't want to see it later, but no, I don't want to hear my Mom and Dad complain about the homework either. Okay, I can work on my homework and watch a show later, another time. Okay, that seems like an in-between solution. Because I'd get the work done, my parents wouldn't be so crabby, and I could still see the show in the long run. I guess I need to pick a choice. Really, I feel like I want to pick the first one. Because I really love that show. But I know the one that will really help everybody. It will help me in school, help my parents be more calm, and help me with my homework is to wait a little bit and have them tape it. I think I'll pick that one. Okay, let me go back and check. That was a pretty good choice. Inside, I did feel kind of crummy. I didn't really like having to wait to see my show. But I got the homework done, and guess what? I found out it got it done even quicker than I thought I would. So it was good to think about my parents and other people. And we did have a pop quiz, and I did really well on it. Let's look at one other example at how we could use this. Your mom asked you to clean your room, but you see the other kids outside playing. Mom is not home from work for another hour. What do you do? Okay, back to our problem-solving steps. What am I supposed to be doing? I'm supposed to be doing the work my mom wanted me to do to clean my room. Boring, though. What are my choices? My mom's not here. She won't know if I went outside and played. Just a little bit. Let me just go outside. I mean, by the time she gets home, I'll be cleaning my room, so she'll think I've been cleaning it the whole time. Yeah, okay, that would be cool. Then I could play and clean my room a little bit, and I'll just trick her. Okay. But inside I wouldn't know how I feel. Okay, any other choices? I could keep cleaning my room, but I would want to look out the window while I'm cleaning my room and see all the other kids that are getting to do more fun things than me. That would be kind of boring, but I know it would be the right thing to do. But you know, there's a third choice. Maybe I can call my mom and see if she answers and tell her some of my friends are outside playing and I wonder if I could play with them a little bit and then clean my room later and see what she says. But I don't want her to say no. Or maybe I could clean my room and then I'll be able to actually go out later and really play. So then the child would have to pick a choice, imagine what could happen with each of those choices, and then check if that choice went well. What we're doing is helping children to think for themselves. So we could use guidelines to say to the child, what do you need to do to solve this problem? How can you solve it? If you don't want certain things to happen, what might you need to do? And what's your plan for this? Can you think of another ending that would work better? I also have helped parents and guardians to role model problem-solving steps for their children, because a lot of times children don't even realize that adults do this stuff in their head. It's been fascinating, and I've seen a lot of good things come out of this when I've taught parents to do this. So, for example, let's say the child's already home from school, mom or dad comes home, and they're just talking out loud. Oh, it's been such a long day. What am I supposed to be doing? Oh, I gotta check your guys' homework, but we still gotta have dinner. We got baths. We got a few things around the house I gotta do before tomorrow, because remember, tomorrow people are coming over. Ugh, but I'm so tired. It was a really long day today. It was pretty hard. My choice is, I could just go to bed and let you guys stay up all night and stuff, and when people come tomorrow, they can just see what a trashy house it is. I don't think that'll go too good, though. You guys wouldn't get your dinner. You wouldn't be able to get any help with your homework if you have questions. And people would probably be pretty hungry and would be kind of crazy around here. Well, maybe we could work as a team, and instead of doing a big dinner, maybe we could get some fast food, or we could do something quick here. And each person could split up a different chore so we could get things done together and make it a little easier tonight. What can I do? Well, I'd really like to go to bed and not have to clean this stuff. I'd really like to not have to think about the chores. But you know what? They're not going to get done by themselves. So then I would verbalize as a parent for the child how we go through, how we take these steps, and problem solve. Just so the child realizes that everyone does this. Parents do this, adults do this. So what I'm going to do, I want to go back and just summarize this second section and all the things that we talked about. The second section focused more on dealing with inappropriate behaviors. We talked about making sure there's a foundation of love, making sure those foundations are there before we give the consequences. That ingredients of well-done rules include that we give a rule one at a time. It's specific. It's observable and measurable. It tells what we're looking for. Instead of phrasing as a question, we say it as a statement. And that as a parent, we role model these rules. We look at what is in the best interest of the child, what teaches some positive skills. We show what the desired behavior is, how it's supposed to be done, where and when. We may have to redefine what in the past we've said in a negative way. So sometimes something like a rules worksheet of finding out what is good for our specific child, given his or her age, developmental level, and maturity is important. We also talked about how to use incremental steps and chain, basically to give cues to the child to increase the likelihood of success. We talked about when we correct to move to where the child's at, be in close physical proximity, don't attend more to non-compliance than compliance, use statements, and again, focus on desired behavior to make sure we're providing attention and reinforcement for positive efforts. We also talked about with building social skills, the importance of not assuming that our child knows these social skills. Social skills are not automatic. Things like meeting someone, including ourselves in activities, and expressing feelings are things that may need to be taught. One of the foundations that I highlighted a lot in the second section was the I message. I feel such and such when or because such and such is happening, and in the future I'd like such and such. The I message gives a formula for someone to say concisely and in a polite, respectful way how they're feeling and what's going on. We can also use those three sections of the I message to make sure that we're understanding the other person. We talked about other areas that may be a cause for concern that could be changed. One was looking at antecedents. We talked about how if we observe the antecedents, we could actually really get some good information about what's important to the child and why they're doing or not doing a given behavior. We also talked about how our reactions can influence a child's behavior as well. And we concluded by talking about problem solving and how our ultimate goal is not to do problem solving and think for the child, but to help him or her to think for themselves, to look at what they're supposed to be doing at a given time, what their choices are, to use our imagination to anticipate if they do certain choices, how they might turn out, to pick a choice, and then to either reinforce when it's a positive choice or what might need to be changed. Thank you for joining me for the second part of today's seminar, and we'll be back with the last and final portion soon.